Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. The sun is yellow, Sirius is blue, and good grief, the sky is too. I like listening to the voice of the universe, Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Comet Watch. Hello and welcome to, oh my gosh, it's August, the August Comet Watch show. Unfortunately, Mary can't join us this month. She is at Solarsphere, and directly after that, obviously, she is heading to the US for the US Eclipse of a Lifetime. Me personally, I'm going to deal with the partial, because I'm so eclipsed out, this is beyond a joke. Okay, so as usual, I have my trusty sidekick, Mr. Trusty Sidekick. Would you like to introduce yourself?
I certainly will. Good evening, buddy. I'm Neil Norman.
And as always, we kick off with the BAA Comet Section Visual Observations page. Thank you, Nick James, for giving us the okay to use this all the time with the latest discoveries. July 9th. Warchart Boom Plot reports a Kreutz Group comet real-time C2 images.
And July the 10th, Warchart Boom Plot reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
July the 10th, Warchart Boom Plot reports two Kreutz Group comets saying real-time C2 images.
A busy man, because on July the 15th, he reported a Mayer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On July 16th, Salil Mayi reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
Again on the 16th, our Warchart Boom Plot again reports a Mayer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On July 17th, Warchart Boom Plot yet again reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
July 18th, and Warchart Boom Plot reported a Mayer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
July 19th, Warchart Boom Plot reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
And July the 19th, a former guest of ours, Treve Prescott, Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
July 21st, Warchart Boom Plot reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
And on the 23rd, Warchart Boom Plot reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
July 24th, discovery of 2017-01 ASAAS space SN1. Reported.
On July the 24th, and Warchart Boom Plot again reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
July 25th, Zijian Zhu reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On the 30th of July, Salil Mul reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On August the 1st, Masanori Uchina, my good buddy on Facebook, reports a Mayer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
On August the 2nd, Warchart Boom Plot reports a Mayer Group comet in real-time C2 images.
August the 3rd, recovery of 2010 D1PY is reported.
On August the 3rd, Peter Birtwistle reports possible cometary activity in 2017 MB1.
On August the 3rd, Warchart Boom Plot reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On the 4th, Warchart Boom Plot reported a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
On August the 5th, Warchart Boom Plot reports a Kreutz Group comet in real-time C3 images.
And August the 8th was the update.
And now we move on to current comet magnitudes, August 8th, and observable region for the same date. Johnson 2015 V2 is currently magnitude 9. It's fading. It's observable 35 degrees north to 90 degrees south. Sorry about the cough. It's visible in evening, and the last visual observation was 2017 July.
Next is Pan-STARRS 2015 ER61, magnitude 10, but fading now. Observable from 55 degrees north to 50 degrees south, best viewed in the morning, and last reported in July.
Okay, ASAAS space SN1, brackets 2017-01, magnitude 10. It's bright, it's 50 degrees north and 75 degrees south. It's visible in the early morning, and the last visual observation was August 2017.
Next is 71P Clark, magnitude 11, but fading now. 35 degrees north and 90 degrees south. Best viewed in the evening and last reported in July.
Next, Pan-STARRS 2016R2, magnitude 11? It's currently bright. It's observable 30 degrees north and 70 degrees south. It's a morning object, and it's not yet been observed.
Next we have 217P Linear, magnitude 12.5, fading now, 25 degrees north to 25 degrees south, best viewed in the early morning and last reported in August.
My old favourite, 29P Schwachmann-Wachmann, 13th magnitude It's a variable. It does go into outburst. If you are imaging this comet, please, please, please contact us via the Comet Watch group, and also get a hold of Richard Miles at the British Astronomical Association, because there is a major observation program for this comet undergoing, and we need all the information that we can possibly get. It's observable 50 degrees north to 80 degrees south. It's best in the morning, and it was last visually observed in July 2017.
Next we have Lemon Young Pan-STARRS 2015 VL62, magnitude 13, but it's steady at the moment. 55 degrees north to 45 degrees south. Best viewed in the morning, but is yet to be observed.
Next is 65P Gun. Magnitude 14, it's beginning to fade, it's visible 25 degrees north to 70 degrees south, it's best in the evening, and again, not yet observed visually. I hasten to add visually.
And next, finally, we have Pan-STARRS 2015-01, magnitude 14 and steady, 55 degrees north to 25 degrees south, best viewed in the evening, and was last reported in July 2017.
Now, the observable region is an approximate indication of the latitude at which the comets may be seen under good conditions. In fact, under really good conditions, comets may be visible outside this range. This is a period when visible for the UK, otherwise for 640 south or the equator as appropriate. The last visual observation is as received by the BAA comet section. Details are often updated on the basis of observations pointed out of updated elsewhere for ongoing. Now, before we actually get started, I would like our guest this month to please introduce himself and tell us a quick bit about himself.
Thank you for inviting me on the show. My name is Richard Pearson, FRES, and I'm a Nottingham man all the way through. And I've carried out many observations of the moon and planets, and some observations of comets over the years. And I've been running a space program, Astronomy in Space, for nearly 4 years, going out month to month.
Now, one of the things you haven't told us, which I think we should, is that you're actually one of the people behind the continual publication of the Patrick Moore Yearbook of Astronomy.
Oh yes, that goes back, the Yearbook of Astronomy goes back, 60 years, and Patrick Moore has been editing it, practically all the way through. It was Dr. J.G. Porter who originally started the Yearbook when he was working at the Royal Greenwich Observatory, and about a year ago, it ran into difficulties, and Dr. John Mason, who was the assistant editor of the Yearbook, couldn't find a publisher for it. It was originally being published by Macmillan. When I heard about it, I got in contact with a good friend of mine, Brian Jones, who was an author, and together we managed to get a publisher on board, Pen and Sword, and we worked really hard over the period of 6 or 7 months. First of all, getting a copy out for 2017, and the 2018 edition is now complete and is with the publisher, and that will be out in the November this year.
And of course, the really nice thing is I believe it will also be available as an e-book across all the platforms.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
I think that's a brilliant thing. One of my pet issues is the fact that my library being what it is, if I relocate myself either to the UK or back to the US for a while, getting my books to and from means I'm separated from them for a long period. The fact that I've now started collecting them as e-books, particularly the comic books, is really great. And I for one, I'm really glad that you guys are going to publish this on Kindle and Nook, just to make it so much easier to take it with me when I go on holiday or somewhere.
And I'm so pleased that we've got Neil Norman on board to tell us all about the Comics on Show during 2018.
Yes, thank you, Richard. It was a great honour and pleasure to be asked to do those bits. I think I've done the meteors for 2018, the comets and the asteroids. I did comets and asteroids for the 2017 book, so thank you very much. It's a great honour to be associated with such a magnificent publication.
Now, let's briefly, before we started the show, we were having a chat. Okay, now, obviously, pre-show chats are pre-show chats. What happens there stays there. However, we were discussing 2017-01. And the interesting fact floated to the surface that not only it's one of these that's causing a few issues. It's a lovely green comet. If you get a chance to look at it through a telescope or a pair of binoculars, do. In early August onwards, it should be observable from the UK. And it will be a binocular object in the late summer, autumn, and early winter. Now, we know that 2017-01, or as most of us are still calling it, Assassin 1, has been visually observed by J.J. Gonzalez. Now, you see, from what I heard, our friend Tony Angel actually managed to image it on the night of discovery. Is that right?
I was going to say that it was right there on the Comet Watch page the very next morning, and I think I commented on the post because I was so surprised to see it there. I only noted the discovery of the comet an hour before, so we did really well to not only find that comet, but take some really good images of it as well.
And I have to admit, it is nice. It is one of those really nice green comets that we get. Seems to be getting quite a lot of. So I don't know whether something has disturbed the Oort cloud or something has been juggled by Jupiter. But this should be quite an impressive comet. I am not going to jinx us prophesizing a Hale Bopp event or an Ihaya Tarki. But if you have a modest instrument, you'll be well rewarded. Who knows what will happen?
Yeah, the thing with this comet, it was discovered, it's about 1.6 astronomical units away from the Sun. If it's it should, theoretically, as it's so bright now, as we said about magnitude 10, I think we said a little while ago, if it was on the correct magnitude parameters, we should have been able, well, the people from the southern hemisphere should have been able to pick this comet up in around about April or even May. So this basically means that this comet is switching on as it's past the frost line, so to speak, mm-hmm. near Mars. And so this could well be a long period comet. We still haven't had enough observations yet, unfortunately, because the moon has been in the way. We're still waiting, but this could well be a long period comet which is waking up from a dormant state. And it's going to be a good show for us. It's going to be very nice near Polaris in about October when it's closest to the Earth as well. And we might squeeze a magnitude 6 or 7 out of it, touch wood.
That would be nice, because I think there's been a lot of promises made about bright comets. This one's going to be, so-and-so's going to be naked eye comet. The thing is, we can't tell. Yes, we can use the predicted orbit. We could use all the information we have. We could say this could possibly be bright. Now, we know full well that certain publications are going to go, a bright, naked eye bright comet will be in our skies in October by the pole star.
Now, you can remember Comet Kohoutek.
Yes, and Comet West.
Yeah.
But we know better. I think that's the problem, because we're actually astronomers, amateur astronomers, and I actually say the amateur part with pride. I'm not a professional. Everything I've learnt at home, and I'm still learning. I think Patrick once said this is one of the few hobbies that you never ever stop learning, because there's always something new, some new information coming out which alters everything you've learned to date. And
on a daily basis. Yeah.
We remember all the fun and games we had with Rosetta. About, I think, 80 books just got relegated to obsolescence within about 3 weeks of the arrival of the Rosetta probe at CG. That was hilarious. Yeah. Someone said to me on Facebook, says, "I'm writing a book about comics. Oh, when's it going to be published? So-and-so." And then he came back and says, "I'm not bothering. Everything I've said is now obsolete. It's a load of whatever." Because what they've been finding with Rosetta has completely thrown everything we all knew and I was talking about out the window. So it just goes to show you, we really don't know what's coming around. And that's probably the nicest thing. We can be out there most nights of the week, at work and weather permitting, and nothing startling happens, and then there's just one night you go out there and something blows you all completely to pieces. This comet 2017-01 was one of those. Nobody saw it coming. Even the big surveys missed it. And I'm wondering if this is why there's such a delay on getting everything published about it, because the surveys did miss it. They should have had the Discovery images, and nobody does, because maybe they were just not looking at the right place at the right time. Somebody else was, and boom, they got the comet. And I think that's the Brian Marsden thing. If it moves or explodes, I want to know about it.
I think somebody will find it on pre-recovery images. I think probably Pan-STARRS has nabbed it somewhere along the lines. It's just, I mean, they have missed comets before.
But then it's too late for them, because, as Gene Shoemaker and David Livia said in the past, if you're in last, you miss the boat. The people who get the reports in first get the name, and Pan-STARRS. Oh, they can say, "Oh my, we had it for 3 months on our images and we never saw it."
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
Missed out. But it just goes to show that, I mean, this comet could have been, like we said, we always can tell people, our listeners, to get out and look. You know, we've mentioned Pan-STARRS and Catalina and all these, you know, great surveys, but we do tell people to get out. This was, could have been, you know, as we've said, Tony Angel took a photograph of it. It was just put in with a name. I mean, I remember Rob Kaufman took an image of a comet 2 years ago, and just out of shot was a comet, G1 Masters.
Yeah.
And he could have discovered that. And that's just out of his camera shot. So people can get them. So they must get out and look.
Well, our good friend Gustavo pointed out, there are places in the sky. And if you know what those places are, you have a darn good chance. The fact that this comet was in the areas patrolled, I understand.
It's in Cetus.
It's one of those things, why didn't they pick it up? What's your opinion, Richard?
Well, as I was saying to Neil earlier today, I think there's something else going on rather than the heat from the sun heating up the comet and giving off volatile gases. But there's something going on with the solar wind coming out from the sun, which is over a cycle. I think the solar wind is somehow causing comets at the moment so close to solar minimum, not being so visible as in the past, whereas round solar maximum they seem to sort of pop out the sky.
Having said that, we've also had the sun play tricks on us. We're supposed to be in solar minimum, and yet we've been we've had quite a few months where the sun has been kicking off solar flares and CMEs, and of course this is not the normal behaviour, as we are led to expect, of a G3 dwarf star. But it is a variable star, we've always known that, and maybe it's being more variable than ever, and that's something we need to sit up and take notice of. Now, Richard, I know that before you moved to your current location, you used to do quite a lot of comet observing yourself. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your observing and the instrument you used?
Well, I use a 4-inch refractor and an equatorial mounting, and for about 5 years I was sort of looking around the sky at I'm mostly interested in planets and the moon, but the comet that's come out most recent was Hale-Bopp, which I think everyone has seen.
Now you also collect you have also a very good collection of books on comets as well.
Well, I've got so much of my study at the moment. I've got about a pile of 14 books at the side of me, all on comets.
So, which are your favourite titles?
Comets and the Origin of Life by Chandra Wickmishanti.
Yeah, I've got one of his books. Yeah, he's a very fascinating character, and so was, and I believe Fred Whipple. Yeah, Fred Whipple was involved in that theory as well.
I don't know, another favourite book was the Catalogue of Cometary Orbits by Brian Marsden. It goes into an awful lot of detail about the positions of comets in the sky, the orbital elements, and I've never seen anything like that published anywhere else.
Yes, Brian Marsden was one of these people who he worked for the Minor Planet Center, and well, he was the Minor Planet Center. Let's face it,
he was.
He was contactable by email, by telephone, by letter.
Carrier pigeon.
Wouldn't surprise me. And he was one of those people, as the famous saying goes, if it moves or explodes, I want to know about it. And under him, the Minor Planet Center really, really came into his own and became what it is. It really became what it is today because of his enthusiasm for computing orbits. That was his main love in life, was as a computer of orbits. And he loved nothing more, from what I've been reading, because I have the book, and I have two books. One was Impact Jupiter by David Levy, and I also have Levy on Shoemaker. And there's a really interesting piece in there in talking about Brian Marsden and his affinity. He was one of those guys, if you had enough data, he could sit there for a couple of days and he could actually pull out an orbit. And the more information he received, the better and better. And he was actually able to backtrack it to a point to where it actually came from in the solar system. And I don't really think, I hope I'm going to be proved wrong in this statement, but I don't think there is anybody today who would sit down with pencil and paper quite the way Brian used to do it in the early days. Certainly computers have moved on as he, during his tenure, but from what I understand from reading from what Gene and David said, this guy was a prodigy. He give him the information, he would churn out an orbit, and once he had an orbit, he'd put out a circular. And of course, if you happen to be the guy that gave him the heads up in the first place, you got yourself a nice little bit of fame.
I mean, I was seeing the program with because Gareth Williams does an awful lot of these comet orbits nowadays, and the you know, he sits at a desk, and the supercomputer that they've got there is unbelievable. And they track through thousands of recorded positions, and it's like you say, it's, but I mean, of course, we're actually on a theme of what's happening right now, because for our listeners who don't know, this is currently the maximum of the Perseid meteor shower, August the 12th, and of course Brian Marsden was quite very instrumental in connecting Swift Tuttle's comeback in 1992, was it? Because I believe he redid all the work and brought, decided that it would turn up again. And I think it's 1991, actually.
Yeah.
A lot of his hard work and as you say, sitting there with a pen and pencil, and you can just imagine the feverishly working out these orbits at his desk.
But as I say, it's a very different ball game, as you pointed out. Now they have a supercomputer to do it. I realise that it probably makes things an awful lot quicker and easier. But where's
we've
the
got
romance
to also in? Remember. Yeah, we've also got to remember that an awful lot of things are being discovered on a nightly basis now, aren't they? I mean, we didn't have the Pan-STARRS, Catalina, Linear, and all these people in the old days bagging hundreds of asteroids per night and comets, did we? In those days, it was just, you know.
Well, I think in the middle of his tenure that the surveys had come online, because I know that some of our previous guests do actually still work for these surveys, and they are still knocking out comets and asteroids and stuff on a regular basis. You've only really got to go through the list of current observable comets to see that. For instance, one of the ones we mentioned tonight, 27217P Linear, or Pan-STARRS 2015-01. And AR-61. They it's almost as if they're wanting to be discovered.
Yeah.
Now, I remember back in the days, and I'm sure Richard agrees with me, back in the days, going back to, say, pre-1956, if somebody discovered a comet, you very carefully told certain people only on telephone. You ask them to go and do a discovery for you, verification, and then, by gosh, you got to move on to get it submitted. You sent in those days, we still got telegrams. If the Minor Planet Center sent out a telegram, you actually got a proper telegram. But that shows how it's all changed. It's all email these days.
Yeah.
And of course, the CCD cameras was only available after the 1990.
Yeah.
And the equipment that's Comet... observers today have is quite remarkable.
Well, yeah, as I say,
they can actually pick up these faint comets quite easily these days, whereas back in 1985 to 1990 it was very difficult.
Yeah, we had to rely on 35mm film and hypersensitizing it, and really hoping that we hadn't messed up with our chemicals and ruined the film, because again, that's something I picked up in Impact Jupiter, was the fact that they actually, Shoemaker Levy 9 was discovered because they had a batch of light damaged film sitting there, and they decided rather than just bin it, they would use it, and suddenly they've got a comet. And then it's like they're going like crazy to hypersensitize good film, get more images, get it into the Minor Planet Center, and then of course we found out that it was going to have a fatal meeting with Jupiter, which everybody was like, we can't believe our luck.
Exactly.
It does happen, and of course Jupiter has kept sucking up objects. We had Anthony Weasley's impactor that everybody thought it was 1999 again. Yeah, no, 1994. Thank you, yes.
It's July 94.
Yeah, I remember it primarily through a very lovely parody that certain members of NASA did put on to... They parodied to a Prince song, 1999, so I get a little confused sometimes. And of course, as I could say, I've been up since about 5 o'clock this morning. And it's now 6 o'clock my time. My excuse, I'm sticking to it.
Shall we tell them what you've been buying this afternoon, or shall we leave that to another show?
Would that be considered going off completely and utterly off track? Oh, actually, I know what we really need to cover.
Yes.
What we need to cover, Mr. Norman, is what you've actually been doing into the preamble to the show, and really having fun with the rest of us, because we can't see them. You've been sealing fireballs, Boliards, haven't you?
I have seen two bolides tonight, yes, from the Perseid meteor shower. One was heading off into the northerly direction at 10:16, British Standard Time, British Summer Time, I should say. And there was another one shoot across the sky just under the Big Dipper about 2 minutes later.
Cool.
So it's the sky is lightening now because the moon is deciding to come up, which is a shame. So a few of the fainter ones will disappear. I haven't seen many whilst we've been talking, but that's because I'm focused and very professional. But I'm sure there's going to be a few more bright ones. Perseus is rising quite nicely now, but unfortunately so is the moon, as I say. So the sky is lightening quite dramatically now. But I will let you know if anything dramatic happens.
Well, please do.
I will.
But as I say, it's one of those nice things. It's, in some respects, our meteor showers are the gifts of comets. Because some of them are associated with certain comets. I'm just trying to get back into some old show notes because I use this information for the Meteor Watch show. Shameless plug.
I'd be interested to know what, because the meteors that are shooting across the sky now, it'll be interesting to know the comet that these are associated with, whether it be, was it 1735 or 1862? Obviously, I think the 1991 appearance would be a bit too early. So these, it's just amazing that this, you know, these little tiny particles have been flying through on their orbit around the sun and for the last 200-300 years, and now all of a sudden they're burning up high above my head right now.
Well, see, the Perseids, it's a prolific meteor shower, and it's associated with Comet Swift-Tuttle. The only reason they're called the Perseids is because the radiant where they seem to come from is in the constellation of Perseus. The peak is around August the 12th. Oh, yes, tonight.
Yes.
Well, it's tonight for us, but it may be a few days hence when the radio show goes out. And they were first recorded in 36 CE, 36 Common Era.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been around for quite a while, but it was really, ironically, Brian Marsden who actually managed to connect which meteor shower is connected with which comet. And of course, as if I remember correctly, and I'm just going to check this fact before I utter it, because I'd hate to make a mistake.
Yes.
Because it's always to the best of my knowledge.
I'm sure you're right.
Yeah. Okay, Orion comets. Okay, because this is... meteor shower is actually debris from P1 Hawley. And I said,
yes.
And I say it as Hawley because that, from what I understand, if you read the diaries of Sir Samuel Pepys and you read Newton's diaries, it is written as Hawley, even though it's spelled as Halley. And it's not Halley, who was actually just a pop star. I was probably get shot for
Patrick Moore. I remember Patrick Moore saying that.
Yes. I think he was being interviewed, and he goes, no, it is not Halley. It is either Halley or Hawley. Most of us say Hawley because of the way it is written in the diaries of personages who knew him, like Sir Samuel Pepys. Richard, have you ever had any issues coming from the pronunciation of comet names?
Not really. What came to mind just then is the I think it's Draconids, the Giacobini meteor shower, associated with 41P Tuttle Giacobini Cresac. Well, the person who actually discovered that was Michael Giacobini, and he was at the Nice Observatory for a number of years, and the Nice Observatory is equipped with a very nice 30-inch refractor telescope. And he went on to discover a further several comets. This one comet is everyone seems to know. 41 Tuttle Giacobini, Giacobini Zinner.
Now, of course, go on, Richard, sorry for interrupting.
I'm getting the names mixed up. So I should have said 21P Giacobini Zinner of the... Draconis meteor shower, but he actually discovered several comets,
and of course that comet returns next September. The aforementioned one, and it should be naked eye objects for the northern hemisphere, so fingers crossed on that one.
Fingers crossed, yes, because As David Lee would say, comets are like cats. They have tails and they do exactly with them as they wish.
Very true. But it's quite a reliable comet. It's been going around for quite a while, so you never know.
Yeah.
We could have an outburst and it could go to minus like Holmes did back in 2007.
Oh, I remember that because that's when I started actually. that's when I first went to the dark side and became an imager. It was August 2007.
Yeah.
And everybody was imaging Comet Holmes in the North American Nebula and stuff. And
yeah.
That was just an awesome experience seeing.
Yeah. I remember looking up the sky and it just looked like I hadn't been out for a couple of nights and we had there's clouds and then all of a sudden it's a clear night and there's this patch of cloud and I thought, that's strange. It's not moving. Strange, not moving. And then next thing you know, it's an outbursting comet by several hundred magnitudes. Larger than the sun was the coma at the time.
Now, of course, if you're like me right now, you're clouded, you can always go to livemeteors.com and you can listen to the echoes that the trails cause in the atmosphere. What happens is radio waves bounce off the ionizing trail from a meteor, and you hear basically you hear a ping, and then so every time you hear that ping, that is the detection of a meteor by a radio signal. Sometimes you might get a radio station that's not actually quite local to you suddenly come up for a few seconds and then die down again. If there's an active meteor shower, the chances are what is causing that is that the VHF radio wave, the FM signal, is bouncing off the comet, off the meteor trail, and then you get to hear it because it's able to suddenly go over the horizon. That's the nice thing about VHF, being horizon limited. If you know there's something going on, whether it's an aurora or spora or sporadic E, but normally the difference between sporadic E and a meteor is a very definite ping. I will put the link into the show notes. Richard, would you like to tell us a bit more about your own observing experiences, please?
Comets or planets?
Please, comets, yeah.
Well, when I was about 7 years old, I really did hear a lot about comet Ikiyosiki, which I believe came up about minus 10 at the time. I was too young to actually see it, but it was in all the magazines and papers. And when I remember comet Bennett, which was quite bright in the night sky, but then I was a schoolboy at the time. But I had a small 2-inch refractor to observe it. And I think that was my first, looking at a really nice comet. But the one that, as I say, in recent times, was Comet Hale-Bopp, which really stood out.
Yes.
But I wish I wish it was around to see comets here in Roland, which held it in the Sky at Night program.
Mm. I just wondered, Richard, did you not see Hike Attack A the year before in 1996? I know we were clouding out quite a bit, weren't we, that spring?
No, I can't remember that comet.
Now, hang on a second. Sorry about that, I had some extraneous noise in my ear. I was about to say how did you learn your way around the sky so that you knew that what you were seeing was a comet and not a nebula or a galaxy?
Well, the thing to do is to look up and learn the constellations, one star pattern after another. And when you learn the bright stars, like the seven stars of the Dipper, and Arcturus in Bootes, and things like that.
Uh, So you were like me. You actually spent the time learning to star hop, to find constellations via other constellations, and that way, once you knew where you were in the sky, you knew what to be expecting to see.
Yes, you explained it better than I do.
I just borrowed Patrick's explanation of it. Works every time. Neil, you got any questions for Richard?
Just wondering about his experiences with Sir Patrick Moore. Because we'd like to have a chat about Sir Patrick Moore. We can't get away from him. So the legend that Sir Patrick was. So have you got any stories, Richard? I know you mentioned one on the pre-show chat.
Well, I think I met Patrick Moore here in nothing but the Victoria Hotel. He came up to do a lecture on the planet Mars, which I think is his favourite subject. And he was going on about cricket part way through. And he was on about he's got a long leaping run, but he can't. He said he can throw googlies. And when I went over to speak to him, I sort of said to him, how do you find Nottingham? And he just sort of looked at me and said, well, I usually draw London to Bristol with a line, and when I cross over that line, I start looking out for Arctic foxes, which I thought was very nice.
And of course, Patrick was not only was he interested in Mars and the Moon. He was one of those people who actually was enthusiastic about comets, and he was involved with the International Comet Hawley Comet Watch group. Well, they still have a webpage, believe it or not. Yes, they're still there from the last apparition. Of course, the 2061 apparition is not going to be particularly favourable, unfortunately. I hope to be here still. Touch wood. Mm. Yeah, touch wood. Yeah, got a nice big piece of wood here. The captain's log.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was my daughter's groan. That was one of my old puns about my desk support. I have so much radio equipment and stuff on it, I had to get a nice big piece of 4x4 to help keep the desk up. So it's the captain's log.
Wonderful.
But
Richard, what was your thoughts about the Rosetta mission? Because I know you're a great scholar of all the latest things that come through. I just wonder what you thought about the Rosetta mission as a whole.
Well, it was absolutely remarkable that the European Space Agency could actually land a small probe on the surface of a comet and put the Rosetta in orbit around the comet. I can't remember the actual name. I think it's a bit a tongue twister.
Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, didn't we lose Churyumov recently? I think Churyumenko's still alive. Was it the other way around? I'm sure someone will tell us if we got it wrong.
Ivana Gerasimenko still with us, yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly, we lost Mr. Churyumov last year.
But we discovered an awful lot of things on the comet. The glycine and DNA chemicals and compositions of water and the evaporation of the surface materials turning into gases as the comet came round the perihelion. But I think I can remember earlier this year, March, a series of about 8 or 9 different papers came out of the Rosetta mission, and I passed them on to you, Neil.
And, you certainly did, yes.
And they were actually full of all the discoveries and everything. It was quite remarkable.
I have to admit that Rosetta really did change the lives of an awful lot of not only the observers and imagers, but the scientists, the planetary scientists. I think about in total about 20 books suddenly went obsolete from the discovery of H2O on the comet and the glycines and everything and the DNA material. Everything suddenly that had been written already or was in the process of being written, just went out the window. Which is kind of how it's supposed to be, I suppose. Really, we do these missions to learn, and suddenly we find out that half of the things that we thought are completely wrong, and it really changes. It's a life changer. Having said that, poor old little Philae. It got lost, but Philae did manage to do some science. It did call home, and it did use its drill.
Yes.
And I really think that that has set the standard for cometary and asteroid missions for the future. I know that Neil and I bang on about this on a regular basis. It would be really, really great to have a space mission to 29 PSW1.
Yes.
Purely because this is a comet that is in the inner solar system, per se. It doesn't come in past Jupiter, but it is readily accessible. It's within attainable transmission. And of course, it's forever having outbursts. Even Holmes is still having outbursts. I still see messages coming up that Comet Holmes is in outburst. Comet Holmes is now in the depths of the outer solar system, but it's still reacting. It's still having moments when it peaks in magnitude and becomes brighter for a short while. And if that can happen that far out into the solar system, what could we learn from a comet that stays roughly between Neptune and Jupiter all the time and doesn't enter the inner solar system and get too close to the sun? There is so much I suspect we could possibly learn there. And of course, we know how we're learning its scheduling when it comes to outbursts. We're beginning to get a lot of good ideas on what causes those outbursts, and I suspect that perhaps Jupiter and Saturn may be involved. I could be totally wrong. I'm sure that somebody who is deep into the science of this particular comet would correct me if I am, but I reckon Jupiter is definitely a culprit into the variability of 29 PSW1. So, Richard, okay, one of our favorite questions. If you had a blank check for a space mission, for a comet, or where would you go? What would you do?
I think I would send the space mission out to the planet Saturn and study Enceladus, because I think there's a great possibility of life in the ocean beneath the surface of the moon. I'd be more prone to be looking for signs of life on moons like Enceladus or even Europa of Jupiter. I'm sorry, I didn't want to send the probe to a comet.
Hey, it's nice to have the tidal sun on us occasionally. But
yeah. That's thrown.
That's
thrown, isn't it?
I was going to say was the other thing is, of course, we could perhaps look at Jupiter's and Saturn's moons more closely and look for evidence of comet strike. We know that it's partially answered. Answered the question as to some unique markings in the Jovian system. I can't remember which satellite is. One of them has a series of craters in a perfect, almost in a straight line. The question is, I suppose, really, is that comet induced? Was that a comet sometime in the past that actually broke up and struck a Jovian moon instead of impacting on Jupiter?
I think if we studied really, really closely, I think you will find like comet nuclei as actual moons. I mean, Shoemaker-Levy 9, I mean, it was snared by Jupiter. I think they worked it out in about, I think it was 1972, was it, or something like that, after several whirling close passes, and it was whizzing around there for years before it impacted and got torn apart. But I think you will find some obsolete comet nuclei lurking around there as a satellite.
Well, we certainly have found asteroids which act like comets, and comets that which act like asteroids. Suddenly, we've been seeing that some asteroids are starting to grow tails and have a coma. So it does beg the question: will we actually observing a dormant comet that has just perhaps under the right conditions become active again?
This is it. Yeah. Until we get probes there to land on them, then we can analyse the chemical structures. I mean, I know Nick Howells, for example, thinks a couple of the moons of Pluto are possibly comet nuclei.
Yeah.
Very suspicious looking things.
Yes, I have to admit the idea of Pluto's moons being comet nuclei is definitely very appealing. And I can see that. I can see the argument there. We've only had one mission to date to Pluto. It was a flyby. It didn't stay very long. It's on its way to the Kuiper Belt and to a meeting with another space duck, I suppose, for want of a better technical term, because we've suddenly found that the object that it's going to is actually a double object. It's a binary, and it may be that close that when New Horizons gets there, it will have to orbit the pair of them. And not just one of them.
And that was a fantastic occultation they caught from down there in the southern hemisphere, wasn't it? Recently.
That was. But how many of these moons are objects that we treat as minor planets with moons are actually perhaps comet nuclei that are dormant and not had the chance to shine?
Well, this is it. I mean, it's like we talked about 29P. We've learned that that's just recently came in from, it's a TNO that's just recently come into this part of the solar system. Mm. I mean, they're lurking out there, and scientists have now discovered that there's far more large comets than they thought there should be entering the solar system. The science is unbelievable.
Does that mean that perhaps our Oort cloud has had a brush with perhaps another system's Oort cloud and stolen some objects?
Apparently,
hurled them into the inner solar system.
Or maybe it's the Planet X that people are looking for at the moment.
Yeah.
Planet 9, I can see as being a very dark, perhaps a gas giant, and perhaps another Neptune. I suppose really we should call it Planet 10, because Pluto does have one of the most important requirements for planethood. It has an atmosphere. Yes, it condenses down at certain points of its orbit, and when it goes into the utter depths of the solar system before it comes back inside the Neptune's orbit, when it regenerates. So does the fact it has an atmosphere, all the other planets have atmospheres of some sorts, does that mean we should reinstate Pluto? I know this is going to be very controversial, but it does beg the question. Should Pluto be readmitted to the solar system as a planet because it has an atmosphere?
I would say, yeah.
But I don't know.
An interesting comet is 96P Macholtz. Talking about comets that may be from other clouds, I mean, it's got a very, very strange chemical composition. People are welcome to look it up on Wikipedia and things like this, and it's a very strange object. It's very low in a lot of the elements that we see in regular comets that come into the solar system or are in Jupiter family type orbits. It's a very strange thing, but I mean, also they think that there's that star that's named, there's a great big long number that's in Hercules, they think is the sister star to our sun. They think that maybe we've stolen some of those, or from this Proxima Centauri system we could have stolen some of those because the sun's reached so far. So we're looking for these extrasolar comets, as we call them, And 96P Macholtz is a very, very strange object. Very strange indeed.
Richard, what are your views on Macholtz?
I can't remember the comment.
It's in a Jupiter family orbit, but its perihelion distance is very, very close to the Sun, within the orbit of Mercury, which is very unheard of. its chemical abundance is bizarre, and it's always on the SOHO images. People can look it up in past perihelion passages, and if you go onto the SOHO image archive, you can actually run the sequence through over the days, and you can actually see the comet. It's very, very bright when it passes through the SOHO images. I'm sure Nick will put some of those up. I'll put a link up to that one.
I will look for a link for that. Oh, that reminds me. There is to be a Pro-Am observing campaign for 46P Witron in 2018. I'm sure someone will tell...
Vertanen,
thank you. Vertanen.
Yeah.
And of course, the interesting thing is, it's going to have a very brief observing window for the UK observers in September of 18, which will be useful to determine the magnitude parameters on this return. But it is going to be best seen from the Southern Hemisphere during this period. It moves quickly into the evening sky in mid-November, and it could be a naked eye, object, I'm going to stress that very much, in December. So it makes a close approach to Earth on 2018 December 16th, passing only 0.7 AU from us, and it should remain within visual range until March of 2019. So, if you are, I'm going to put a picture in here for the BAA because I think they really deserve it. If you really want to read some of the information and some of the papers that we get access to as members, join the BAA or join the SPA, because if you can then access the comet section databases that they have and read some of the really technical information. I'm honest, if I spent all my evenings online in those archives, I never get anything else done. There's just so much information.
Absolutely. And Vertanen will be a nice magnitude. It should get to -2.
Yeah.
Sorry. Magnitude 2, but the listeners, who go out to view it, must remember that it's a periodic comet, very old, and it will be very, very diffuse, which will mean it will have a low surface brightness, so it will not be magnitude 2 and plainly obvious. It will look very, very dim because of the low surface brightness. It will have a large coma, so be wary of that, because magnitude 2 comet sounds like, you know, sort of like the pole star brightness. It won't be. So people must sort of like, this is another thing that people have to do. They have to learn the degrees of condensation for coma, you know, because it's very, very deceptive to say that, oh, we're going to have a comet magnitude 2. But if it's an old, old comet, being around the block a few thousand times, it's very, very low surface brightness. So it's not what you think it will be.
As always, we hope it will be bright. But sometimes even we get our sums wrong, and what prior observations say should happen isn't always guaranteed. And I'm beginning to wonder if more and more the solar wind does have a key to, play in how bright comets get. But I guess that's down for somebody else to figure out. But right now we are going through a period of solar activity. We got a very bright comet, 2017-01. So we lucked out this time.
I think Richard is Richard's got a, you know, the great theory about the solar wind on these things. So
Richard,
well, it was just that Comet Kuratek was meant to be a spectacular comet, which, as it came round in November time, it sort of fizzled out. And then the same thing happened with Comet Ison. Everyone was saying it was going to be a spectacular comet. So I was thinking that there must be something to do with the solar wind coming from the sun that has something to do with it. But I want to say there's two types of solar wind. There's two types of solar wind. There's solar wind coming from sunspots, and that only reaches the Earth in about 4 to 5 days. But then you've got the solar wind coming from coronal mass ejections, which is so energetic, it reaches the Earth in a couple of days.
So basically, depending on what the solar event is, depends how quickly a comet could actually switch on and how bright it could suddenly become when we're not expecting it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That'd be interesting to link solar cycles with comets. For example, Comet Hale-Bopp, we mentioned a little earlier on, in 1997. It'd be interesting to see what part of the solar cycle the sun was in and what events that we've just mentioned were happening around about the time when Hale-Bopp, you know, turned on in 1995, I believe it was discovered, and then it finally dimmed out in about 2002, I think they last saw it, 2004. Very, very long time, I know that much.
I'm actually looking that up right now.
yeah,
solar cycle 22.
Maximum?
I'm just looking into that.
I think.
It had a maximum count of 212.5 spots. So.
Because wasn't there a maximum 2008. So.
Yeah.
96 would have been a minimum, maybe 95.
Solar cycle, yeah, it's about a 9.9 year cycle.
Yeah.
So the maximum smooth sunspot number observed during the solar cycle was 212.5, and that was by November 1989, and the starting minimum was 13.
Right.
So during the minimum transit from solar cycle 22 to 23, there was actually 309 days with no spots.
Right.
So,
because that's interesting.
The next cycle the next cycle started in 1996 to 2008.
And Hale-Bopp turned on in about 96, didn't it? I think Terry Lovejoy was the first person to see it with the naked eye, and one of the last two, I believe.
Quite likely.
Because it's the record 18 months naked eye, last comparable to the comet of 1811, I believe, but it beat that easily.
It is possible.
The solar
cycle and could affect how a comet switches on. And to what degree it switches on.
Yeah, I mean, we've all seen that footage of Comet Encke losing its tail by a coronal mass ejection and ripping it off.
Yeah.
So I think, Richard, you might have stumbled on something that I haven't even thought about, to be honest with you.
Well, in all the books I've ever read, it's always when a comet comes into the sun and passes Mars, the heat of the sun heats up the ices and then the tail develops. But no one ever mentioned about the solar wind and its effect on comets.
No. That's interesting, yeah, because when it gets over the frost line, the sublimation begins around about the orbit of Mars, as you say. But, yeah, as far as I've got, was the Encke tail rip-off event. So it's very interesting.
I'm going to see it go a bubble all the way around the sun, which is the heliosphere, and the solar wind bathes all of the planets and even the comets that are passing through the solar system inside that region.
Well, if a few of our listeners can sort of like get their textbooks out and a few pens and pencils and let us know, that'd be great.
Well, looking at the solar cycle variations, starting with 75 to 2005, we had a maximum in 80, in 1990, minimum was about 95, and again it was on the rise between 2000 and about 2003. Looking at the chart I'm seeing on Wikipedia, if that's for solar cycle 22,
that'd be interesting to correlate maybe Comet Holmes from 2007 October. If people could work back and say there's anything from the sun at that point, if we can get data, or the listeners can.
Oh, I'm sure I'm sure it's out there, because the sunspot data and everything, and Maxima cycle and the cycles, that was all out there. The thing that interests me is, if that's the case, is it Jupiter or Saturn that is the switch for 29 PSW1? Because that one is a fairly tight orbit. It's not that particularly long cycle. So is it as it comes in too close to Jupiter, or maybe passing Saturn? Is that what's switching it on? And perhaps by the time it's in between the two planets...
I think it actually passes closer to Saturn, doesn't it?
Is it tidal?
Is it Saturn? Where normally is the comet compared to... Because it's fairly stable, isn't it? So I don't know if they're the opposite sides of the solar system. Not without looking, I must admit. I remember Richard saying something to do with Saturn when we interviewed him. But I think they were almost opposite each other in the solar system. Jupiter and 29P, I think. I wouldn't put money on it. But I do remember him saying Saturn was a big influence in probably dragging it into its current orbit now. And it's basically gotten into a situation where it's stabilized between the two.
Well, looking at the orbit of 29P, it gets close to... I'm not sure I can share it as a link, but when I'm looking at it, it stays close to Jupiter. It grazes Jupiter's orbit at certain points. Not close to the planet itself, though, because it seems to me that as Jupiter is racing around on its orbit, there is a point where the comet actually touches the orbit of the planet. It does go out as far as Saturn. Now, so it's in a slightly offset circular orbit. I'll see if I can put this into our private chat. Just one second. Show the DARPA. I want to show. I can't. Trying to do this. It's very hard to describe, because I'm looking at a solar system, a 3D solar system simulator that shows the orbit of 29P. SW1. Now, the way it's moving relative to the solar system is, at one, the Saturn appears when it's the comet is actually at its closest approach to Saturn's orbit. Saturn is actually not there. It's kind of like a 4 o'clock position. So by the time the comet gets to Saturn's orbit, Saturn isn't there, and it's kind of the same with Jupiter, because it will graze close to Jupiter's orbit, but not technically close enough to the actual planet itself. I'm going to try and put it into the links for people to have a look at. It is explained that I'm actually on the skylive.com for 29Ps. It's an experimental feature, and it does require a WebGL enabled browser, but it does represent the orbit quite accurately, and it does give you food for thought, because it never gets into the inner solar system. It always stays out. The closest it comes is Jupiter, and the furthest it goes out is Saturn. So there must be some form of tidal actions from both planets, perhaps causing the comet to outburst. I'm sure if Richard's hearing this, he'll put us right.
Well, of course, Jupiter is the biggest magnetosphere in the whole solar system. It actually stretches out almost to Saturn's orbit. I know it's sort of an egg-shaped magnetosphere, but it's still quite a large area for a comet to actually hit and pass through.
And actually, in regards to my comments about Pluto earlier, Pluto actually comes within the Uranus's orbit on its travels. It's currently heading out into the depths of the solar system right now. So it comes quite, does come in quite appreciably. So yeah, I think perhaps a permanent monitoring, permanent space probe there would be good.
Get hit as much as...
Yeah, as you can probably hear, my daughter making the comment, it doesn't appear to get as hit as much as perhaps Jupiter or the Jovian satellites.
Well, I was saying it does, because if you look at where it is at any given time in the solar system...
Good point. Did you hear that, by the way, chaps? Hello? has the curse struck again? Neil, are you there?
I'm still here, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I was just saying...
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, I was just looking at 29P, actually, while we're still talking about it. Apparently the closest approach it's made to Jupiter hasn't happened yet since 1930, and that's going to happen in 2037. But its minimum orbit intersection distance is 0.72 astronomical units, which is quite a bit, so... And there's nothing there for Saturn, so it doesn't seem like they have an awful lot to do with it. But then again, as you say, Jupiter's gravity is so strong that everything works around that when it comes into the solar system. All comets, when they get to 30 astronomical units, it's all determined by when they're calculating orbits, for people who don't know, they take into account Jupiter. So it's very important that when we're doing Oort cloud comets, when we find them coming in 30 astronomical units, that's when the influence of Jupiter begins. So
sorry, Neil.
No, sorry, carry on, Richard.
I would say that Jupiter has an influence on the asteroid belt between the planets Mars and Jupiter. It pulls the asteroids into concentric rings with gaps in between them. So these are called Cape with gaps, but it does have an effect on all those asteroids, so why not comets?
I think the interesting thing, of course, is depending on Jupiter's mood, either its effect on a comet or an asteroid is benign, or it's perhaps potentially dangerous, because it could, as well as hoovering up the debris of the solar system, it could potentially hurl an object deeper into the inner solar system.
Like Comet Lexel in 1770.
Yeah.
So,
it's one of those lovely things. We just as when we think we've quite got it solved, something a comet will come along, and it will completely throw everything out the window. So, it's probably one of those nice things. You never quite know what's going to happen. You never quite know what you're going to get. And at the end of the day, whatever you get...
Every flavoured beans.
I think you heard that one, didn't you, Neil?
I did.
that is Starstorm. Starstorm helps me out with the Event Horizon show on Friday nights. but yeah, she likes to get involved with astronomy, and she has a fun time with it. I'm so happy. I've succeeded as a father. I've got somebody else hooked on astronomy. It's been a fascinating evening. I really enjoyed it tonight. We're getting to the point where we're actually 1 hour, coming up to 1 hour 15 minutes. So I think we really had better wrap the show, because I know that we have an awful lot of leeway, and AFM does rearrange its schedules depending on how long we run. Richard, I just want to thank you for coming. It's been great having you on the show, and I hope you come back at a later date and rejoin us.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you, Neil.
So, thank you, Richard, for coming on.
Yeah, great, thanks. So just remind us, I guess, for everybody to say goodnight. So it's goodnight from him.
And it's goodnight from me.
And it's goodnight from me.
Goodnight, everyone.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world. and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts. AFM.